The Shanghai organization is gradually expanding its presence on the global stage, moving beyond the regional sphere step by step. It has placed a wide range of issues on its agenda, both in economic as well as political and security domains.
Araki added that the upcoming summit will finalize the development strategy of the SCO and its member states, particularly across key areas including energy and trade. Elsewhere in his remarks, Araki welcomed the organization's condemnation of recent U.S. and Israeli acts of aggression against Iran and its nuclear facilities. He emphasized that nearly all regional and international organizations denounced the aggression. A memorial has been held for the media workers martyred in the Israeli strike on the headquarters of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, IRIB, on June the 16th. The ceremony, attended by top officials, cultural figures, and the journalist families, was held at Bilal Mosque in the Iranian capital. Gisu Misha Ahmadi has more.
At Bilal Mosque in Tehran, grief and gratitude fills the air as hundreds gather to honor the memory of two martyrs, Nima Rajapur and Masume Azimi, who lost their lives in the Israeli regime's missile strikes on IRIB headquarters' glass building.
My husband was a committed journalist. He was always ready to sacrifice his life for the greater good. He stood up for what was right, not for personal or material gain.
Senior government officials and figures from across IRIB's ranks attended the ceremony, paying tribute to the colleagues who made the ultimate sacrifice.
The martyrs of IRIB are a clear testament to the atrocities committed by the Israeli regime and was broadcast live before the eyes of millions. They gave their lives, but the truth they stood for will never be forgotten. This building, once known as the Glass Building, is now a mirror reflecting their courage and sacrifice. It has become a national emblem of defiance.
Portraits of the two martyrs stand tall, sending a strong message of resilience in the face of aggression. Nima Rajapur and Masume Azimi represent the quiet force behind the news, voices that never sought the spotlight, but remain steadfast in their pursuit of truth and public awareness.
According to Articles 48 and 52 of the Additional Protocol to the Geneva Conventions of 1949, which safeguard civilians during armed conflict, including journalists, any attack on members of the press not engaged in combat is strictly prohibited and constitutes a war crime. But this attack will not silence the truth.
The Israeli strike on IRIB's headquarters, known as the Glass Building, has left behind shattered walls, but not shattered resolve. The charred building and the remains of once busy newsrooms stands as a reminder that Nima Rajapur and Masume Azimi are not just martyrs, they are national heroes.
Here at the shattered IRIB glass building, the sacrifice of our martyred colleagues echoes. This is a symbol of resilience that stands tall, a testament to a voice that will never be silenced. Tehran.
Well, hundreds of African migrants have held a rally in the French capital to protest against racist immigration policies by the French government and increasing police brutality.
While the values of the French Republic are not lies, the people who work in the government are making sure that these values never become reality. We respect the values of this republic because it is our second country, but racist people in the government are mistreating foreigners. As it concerns police brutality, not all police officers are racist, but there are people in the police who are racist towards foreigners.
The appeal we are making to the French state, to all its leaders, is that we are human beings, first and foremost. Secondly, we are work colleagues of the French state. These people are not here by chance. They are not thugs. They are workers who contribute and even participate in the nation's economy.
The protest was organized by different rights groups. The protesters called for equality, criticizing the French government for pushing racist and nationalist policies. The demonstration follows President Emmanuel Macron's recent agreement with British Prime Minister Keir Starmer on a controversial one-in-one out migration deal. Under the swap agreement, France will take back asylum seekers who have crossed over to the UK in small boats. In return, London will grant asylum to legitimate asylum seekers with British family connections. Rights groups have criticized the arrangement as inhumane. A pro-Palestine demonstration has been held in the Mexican capital to condemn Israel's genocidal war on Gaza. The demonstrators called on the Mexican government to sever ties with the Tel Aviv regime. Here's a report.
Activists, artists, and citizens from the Common Platform for Palestine in Mexico called for a gathering at the Monument to the Revolution in the Mexican capital to denounce the Israeli genocide against Palestinians in Gaza as well as the Tel Aviv regime's atrocities in West Asia.
Above all, it's quite hard that after almost 2 years of all these pro-Palestine demonstrations by the Mexican people, and after the Israeli aggression against Iran, we see the Mexican government strengthen its economic and military ties with the Israeli regime. This is another manifestation of imperialism, which in this case comes through Israel. But behind this is the United States, that has its own interests in Mexico.
During the demonstration called Wave for Peace, activists called for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. At the same time, they condemned Mexican companies such as Pemex and Orbia for profiting from the massacre of the Palestinian people.
Let the people speak, let the weapons be put down, and let the people decide how they want to live. It's unacceptable that a death-driven warlike model is imposed on us, one that benefits from war and armed conflicts.
With music, poetry, and anti-imperialist speeches, Mexicans once again urged the Mexican government to take a strong stand against the Gaza genocide and to sever all types of relations with Israel. Our Secretary of Security maintains commercial relations and shares political and military information with Israel. These are also used to suppress protests and social movements in our country. So, when we look at it from that perspective, it's something that's affecting us too.
EU ministers hold emergency talks in Brussels to assess U.S. President Donald Trump's threat to impose 30% tariffs on all imports from the 27-nation bloc. Economists warn the move, due to take effect on the 1st of August, would have devastating consequences. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital. They became
very strong, very fast. Experts agree that if Trump follows through on his threat to impose a 30% tariff on EU imports, transatlantic supply chains would collapse, devastating businesses and wiping out jobs. EU trade ministers held an emergency meeting in Brussels on Monday to assess the situation.
If you want peace, you have to prepare for war. It's not that we want a war, but we need to prepare in order to give our commissioner the strongest possible negotiation position. And I think we managed to achieve that today.
Hungarian Minister Levente Matyar told his EU counterparts he, quote, strongly resents the European Commission's failure to strike a trade deal with Washington, despite, in his view, having had ample time. Some analysts say he has a point.
This trade debate is not new. The European Union should have been more prepared than they are today. So it is definitely linked to the security conundrum, because the Europeans remain extremely dependent on the United States.
The EU now has just over 2 weeks to persuade Trump to back down from the sweeping 30% tariff. Both sides have faced criticism in the European Parliament, though most of it is aimed squarely at Trump.
This isn't just a trade dispute anymore. It's pressure, it's coercion, it's a deal-making of the worst sort. It's an attempt to put a price on what we are.
Each day, 4.4 billion euro worth of goods and services flow between the EU and the US. On Monday, ministers agreed to pursue new trade partnerships and strengthen existing ones. But few believe this will alter Trump's course. While both sides stress the importance of cooperation, underlying tensions regularly resurface, which complicates efforts to reach lasting agreements. This is now particularly the case, given that the White House is occupied by the most unpredictable U.S. president in history. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
While the U.S., U.K., and EU condemn atrocities committed by Sudan's paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, a closer look reveals deep hypocrisy. From past migration deals to ongoing arms flows, critics argue that Western powers have quietly enabled the rise of the RSF while claiming to support peace and democracy. Abdullah Hussein reports.
Sudan's war continues to claim lives, and while the U.S., U.K., and EU publicly condemn the RSF, their reactions tell a different story. Rights groups have confirmed the RSF is using foreign-supplied armored vehicles fitted with European-made weapons. The UN has also tracked repeated arms flights into RSF areas, some disguised as humanitarian aid.
This war was planned internationally by what's known as the Quartet. Ambassadors led by the British ambassador, the American ambassador, along with two ambassadors from our countries, foremost among them the UAE, they planned this after pushing for the framework agreement, which was intended either to force Sudan to dismantle its armed forces and establish a secular government without Islam, or if Sudan rejected the agreement, to ignite a war.
Despite declaring RSF atrocities genocidal, the U.S. has avoided targeting the external supply networks behind them. The U.K. sanctioned a few financiers, but still welcomed RSF-linked figures to peace talks. The EU is also under scrutiny for funding RSF through its Khartoum process, migration deal, sending equipment, and training to Sudanese forces that included RSF units. That support helped grow the very group now accused of mass killings.
These countries are the ones behind it. They support Israel, and they support the UAE in backing the RSF. Their atrocities are plain for the entire world to see. They kill, rape, and loot civilians, and yet no one dares to speak up or condemn them, not even with a single word.
The Sudanese army is a long-standing institution that managed to defeat the rebellion. As a result, the international position has now shifted toward alignment with the RSF, turning a blind eye to their violations.
Now, as aid and diplomacy are tied to Western conditions, Sudan's new government faces immense pressure to conform to foreign agendas. The result? A war machine, partly built by international actors, condemned by words, but protected by silence. With Western words outpacing their actions, and Sudan's future caught in the balance, the question remains, will the world confront its own role in this war, or continue hiding behind statements of condemnation? Abdullah Hussein, Khartoum.
Well, thank you very much. Goodbye.
You raise your tired hands toward the sky, and the dark night lights up as you pray. Your hijab and this cold air is filled with the fragrance of jasmine flowers. Come and walk again in our troubled streets and lanes, and heal the scars of our city with your sense of
we Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners, welcome once again to Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab. Grateful as always to be here with you. The show is about reconnecting with our purpose as parents and mentors grounded in the sacred guidance of Holy Quran, the sayings of Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, and the noble words of our Imams, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon them. Well, in this program, we try to answer questions and the topics we discuss basically to guide the parents to be best mentors in Islamic education. And we take advices from our guest expert. Today we have the pleasure to be with Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, Brother Liaqat Abbas is a research scholar in the House Ilmi of Qom, and also he has a background in psychology, which makes him the perfect guest for our program. So, Brother Liaqat Abbas, when talking about Islamic upbringing, is it different when it goes for boys and when it goes for girls?
Yeah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, of course, the upbringing of a boy differs from a girl, you know, in Islam. There are certain things which needs to be taught to a boy, and there are certain things which needs to be focused when it comes to a girl, yeah?
So when it comes to gender, there's difference?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, there's gender-specific upbringing.
All right.
In Shia Islam. Of course, there are common grounds as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about gender-specific upbringing. Because in the religion of Islam, few duties are upon the shoulder of a male. Example, taking up responsibilities, earning, everything. Yeah, so because it's wajib. When it comes to the concept of obligatory things, then it's upon the male, that it's obligatory upon the male. That he should be the bread earner,
yeah.
He should earn and he should provide it for his family.
Right.
Unlike the female, for the female, it's not wajib. So
right.
Even if she doesn't work, she won't be asked on the day of judgment. Yeah.
Right.
So you see, this is over here itself. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is making specific, okay, you know what? This is what you need to know.
It's a major responsibility. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. As for the girl, of course, the load of tarbiyah or upbringing, like from a real infant stage of the baby, falls upon her. You know, like the mother is, they say that the real role model for the baby. The mother is the real upbringer when the baby is really small. So definitely the things of wisdom and like how to raise the child, and how to be with the child, how to be emotional, loving, caring, and how not to be overacting or overreacting, example, upon the baby or what the baby does, should be upon the girl, and she should be knowing everything. Yeah.
Right.
So there's a kind of difference between both of. Of course, even the boy, I mean, like, even the male should be knowing it, but the major responsibility, because the mother is always with the child.
Right.
So it depends like how I am upbringing my child. Example, if I upbring my child like my boy, okay,
mm-hmm.
if it is a male, in the manner that I have to upbring the girl, then the qualities which he should be having when he grows up will be lacking
them.
In him.
All right.
Yep.
Now there's a point to ponder on that, and we'll take a short break here. We'll be back in a while.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman. Don't give in to Shaitan. Oh, you who believe, give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul Muhsinin, wa Khaliquna, wa Rasiquna, wa Huwa ala kulli shay'in qadir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas is here helping us with valuable insights on Islamic upbringing. Well, Brother, you were talking about the gender difference, like if there's a boy and a girl, the upbringing is not necessarily the same for the both genders. It differs as their roles when they become adults differ. So does the upbringing.
Yep, definitely. So example, if I have a baby girl example, okay, yeah, and I am doing the upbringing like how it should be done, then she's going to become a proper mother when she grows up.
Right.
She's going to become, I would say, the mother which Islam wants her to be.
Right.
You see? So it depends on my upbringing of my baby girl, like when she's really small. And of course, like the process goes on, like when she's 5, 7, 10, 12, you
yeah
see? So it's very crucial and important for me to know about how to do upbringing, about if it is a male and if it is a female.
So as a mentor, as a guide, as a father, it's very important for you to go through the processes like how the upbringing differs in both genders.
And definitely. The point over here is, unfortunately, people don't think about it. Yeah. Example, like they have...
So maybe there's lack of awareness or...
Maybe they don't have like awareness, yeah, of course. But other than that, they are not even interested sometimes. Like, few people are not even interested. They just do upbringing.
Because, you know, upbringing, real upbringing, real nurturing takes efforts.
Yeah.
And definitely. No one is like always ready to make more efforts or.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, unfortunately.
But we as parents and mentors will be asked tomorrow.
Sorry?
We will be asked tomorrow.
Definitely,
like,
we will be asked tomorrow. And the general concept is they do upbringing equally. Like, they just, okay, you know what? They are growing, so let them grow. Be it male or female, doesn't mm-hmm matter. They do it on common grounds, yeah? Unfortunately. Of course, few might teach their girls, example, like few arts or few specific things, example.
Skills.
Like skills, yeah, exactly. Like sewing the clothes, stitching the clothes, example. And for the boys, example, they might teach them about swimming or whatever, okay? But this is like a very basic thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is like mostly material. But when it comes to upbringing, like on the real basis, I would say, like what they have to teach to their kids, then they lack the skills over there, unfortunately. So over here, the first responsibility, if it is a male, is the father or the mother, the parents should teach about leadership, because
right
he should do the management of the house, and not just the general leadership inside the house, okay? Even financial management,
all
yeah?
Right.
House management, everything, like with regards to management. Okay, if you want to purchase something, like the father should take the child, if it is a male, should take the child with him to the market, should teach him, okay, this fruit is good, this vegetable is good. When you, like, of course, when he grows up a bit, then give a bit of responsibility to the child. Okay, my dear son, now you choose the fruits, you choose the vegetables for me. I will tell
let
you if it is correct or not.
Themselves, yeah?
Yeah. You see?
So yeah, let's discuss more, but let's take a short break here and we'll be back in a while.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "A righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and I'm Zainab, your host. Brother Liaqat Abbas is here with us, and We are discussing how the upbringing differs in both genders, male and female. So you were talking about there's lack of awareness, definitely. That's how parents usually go with a common upbringing with both the genders. But you said the results will be also not as desired. So when coming back to male child, you said that we should teach them the management and leadership skills by just practically taking them to the market, for example.
Yeah, exactly. And there are many more, of course, if it is a male. Yeah, if it is a female example, there are skills like cooking and everything, which normally the mothers do. Okay, unfortunately, there are a few mothers who don't even do this. They're like, oh, you know what, my daughter is too small for this. Even if the daughter is like 10 or whatever,
yeah.
They're like, no, she's too small, so she should be playing or going to school, and that's it. And the daughter is going to learn cooking after she gets married, which is not a good thing in general aspect, unfortunately. So with regards to women,
the
main responsibility which falls upon the parents to do upbringing for the female child, yeah, is haya, is chastity.
Modesty.
Exactly. So because if this is there, this will take that girl, that female child, to heights which no one can ever imagine.
Yeah.
This is very important. Haya is very important. This should be taught to the child. Okay, example, tomorrow when this child goes in public and a male approaches, example, okay, maybe it's the classmate, okay? How should this child of yours
react,
respond? Or how should she react or respond? How should she answer? Example, if a male person, example, is asking more questions or is trying to, example, like...
Be more friendly,
yeah, exactly. Or trying to give hands or shake hands or whatever. The child
because
should
not
know.
All cultures are Islamic cultures.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they may be exposed to some maybe non-Islamic setup.
Yes.
So they should be ready to respond.
Yes, definitely. So they need to be taught beforehand itself. This is upbringing. This is the part of
because upbringing. Because that response is not going to come overnight.
Definitely. It's a very gradual process. I remember a friend of mine who happened to go take her child to masjid, okay? And there were a few girls, like 3 to 4 girls, whose hijab wasn't nice.
Proper hijab, yeah.
Yeah, so it was improper hijab. And this girl, she's a very modest girl. She started to copy their hijab style.
All right.
And my friend, he got so upset. He was like, oh my God, no, what should
I can't even take to mosque.
You know what? Yeah, exactly. You know, it took him 1 month to change her mindset.
Oh.
From not doing improper hijab to a proper hijab.
So like just a visual scene.
Yeah.
Especially a live visual scene can have that deep impact.
And it took him 1 month. He shared with me personally. And he was like, it's very difficult to make her understand. So you see, it's not like an overnight process.
Yeah.
And there are more things where you need to teach if it is a boy, you have to teach him about leadership, about management. And when he grows 14, example, teach him financial management and everything. Yeah. Likewise, if it is a girl, haya, and like how to do tarbiyah. If she sees you doing good tarbiyah, being kind, being like example, loving, affectionate, she will also have the same qualities when she gives a child, inshallah.
Yeah, thank you so much, brother.
Thank
so
you.
This brings us to the end of another heartfelt session on Islamic upbringing. I want to thank you, Brother Liaquat Abbas, for
thank
being
you.
Here and for your valuable contributions. And also, dear listeners, it's not just like if you work for hire and your daughters, then you should not be working in that modesty for the boys. But it's like sometimes some values, some virtues are more in a specific gender. So yes, definitely management is something that has to be learned by both the genders, and modesty is something that, again, has to be learned by both the genders. Thank you for tuning in. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, take good care. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small, a way of life.
heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to Women of Resistance. What we, the mothers in Gaza, have had to live through in this past year and a half, may no mother ever have to live through that again, says Asmin Khalil Naeem Hassan, mother of four in Gaza. Having lost her husband, widowed mother further says they have become shadows, bodies with no souls, as they await to see who the next missile will take. Here is her story.
Mothers are one of the foundational pillars of Palestinian life, history, and future. They bear their burden with grace and steadfastness. Their humility and humanity knows no bounds. This Israeli genocide has sought to erase everything they represent, but these brave women will never allow this to come to pass. Sadly, life in Gaza has meant constant periods of Tel Aviv-initiated violence against the people already living in the world's largest open-air prison. This war is proving to be the most deadly, but it wasn't the first experienced by Yasmin. As a mother of four, Yasmin reflects on her own educational journey, pledging to do everything for her own children when this genocide finally ends. Looking ahead to a future when death and destruction are now Gaza's permanent shadows can be difficult. It's been tough to come to terms with the scale of this fresh onslaught on the Palestinians. For a people used to impose violence, this was a new and ugly reality. Yasmin has suffered her share of losses, including that of her beloved husband during this genocide. Sadly, her story is the story of so many of Gaza's new class, the war widows. Washington has made no secrets of the nefarious plans they have for Gaza and its people. Palestinians know what it's like watching interlopers attempt to displace them for land. Despite the difficulties Yasmin and her four young children are experiencing, the promise of a better future, personified by faith, is at the heart of their coping strategy. Gazan mothers are brave, but they're tired. Tired of empty rhetoric, of false brotherly bonds, of political posturing. The war needs to stop. Palestinians need to be free. Yasmin wants what we all do, a better future for our loved ones, one dominated by a new peace, a lasting peace.
Joining me in the studio today to discuss Yasmin's journey is Father Frank Galli, an Anglican priest. Welcome, Father.
Thanks for inviting me.
Father, let me start by asking you, did you really think we'd still be here a year and a half, that this would still be going on? And how can human beings stoop to the levels that the Israelis have?
The answer is yes and no. No, because, yes, as you say, I mean, what we just watched is heartbreaking. It is the horror of what we have witnessed, or we're still witnessing every day, is unbelievably beggars of imagination that anyone can stoop so low to starve, murder, wound, and completely wipe out, or try to wipe out, a whole population, over 2 million people. women, children, the lady in question and the children. I mean, you know, this is not sentimentality. Anybody, any person with a modicum of decency would absolutely be aghast at the suffering of children, innocent people by definition. So, I mean, the people of Gaza and Palestine in general have suffered what in Christianity we call it a Calvary, which is a path of suffering, alluding to Jesus' suffering on the way to the cross. And incidentally, I believe a Palestine, Gaza Palestine today, could be described as the Christ among the nations. Mm-hmm. Gaza is the Christ among the nations. We used to say some nations, Poland under the Tsarist Russian oppression, was the Christ of the nation. Well, today it is Palestine.
Does this mean that you are expecting Palestine to be the salvation for the world then?
Well, that is a very good question. I would like to say that it could be the beginning of an awakening. It could be, it depends on God. But I want to come back to your question. So I did not expect this to be horrible, but in a way I did. Yes, because I'm aware of a Zionist project which has been to completely to wipe out, to either transfer or remove a Palestinian population onto a nearby country or the desert or whatever, or eliminate, destroy it. This is not new. Menachem Begin, who was prime minister of Israel many years ago, who tricked President Carter, United States president, into a Camp David agreement, Menachem Begin made it quite clear that he wanted the Palestinians to be expelled, to be driven out. And incidentally, Menachem Begin was a former terrorist, which reminds us Israel was born out of terrorism.
Absolutely.
Israel is a terrorist state in its inception. It has a bloody gall, the effrontery of calling resistance terrorists. I mean, it just, once again, it tells its own story. So I was aware of this project to completely eliminate the Palestinians, and West Bank included, yeah. Which Begin called, they still called it the Hour Brigade, they used Judea and Samaria, the biblical names for those lands, which of course begs the question, because the Jews today have very little to do with the ancient Hebrews, but yeah. Leaving that aside.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Christianity, since you bring in the Bible. You know, there's a lot of talks about Muslim countries not doing enough, and we've heard of, you know, Yasmin saying that they're only sending them shrouds and, you know, earpieces to block the bombs. But also, Father, you know, Gazans have also got Christians. What is the Christian world doing about that?
So the Christian presence in Gaza is very small. I think it's less than 1%. But it's symbolically important. There is a church in Gaza which was bombed, an Orthodox church, St. Porphyria, I believe, was bombed by Israel. They didn't give a damn. And so, yeah. Christians.
It's also the birthplace of Jesus, so whatever the population is rather important, isn't it?
Bethlehem, yeah. Yes. There is actually a pastor, Munther Isaacs, yeah. Who was in London recently, who is from Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. He's a Lutheran, and he gave a very powerful, I went to a church where he spoke, very powerful witness of what it is like for Palestinians to be in the Holy Land today. It's a complete the new martyrdom once again. If you ask me, what are the Christians doing today? Well, there is the Quakers, a small but important part of Christianity in this country. There has been an annual gathering where they came out very recently saying that they decide to say quite openly that what is happening in Gaza is genocide. Mm-hmm. So they have accused Israelis of committing genocide. That is, it's a beginning. Now, whether it will spread out to the mainline churches, I doubt it, because at the end of the day, well, it's partly the stranglehold which the Zionists have placed on the minds and hearts of many Christians. Oh, well, the Jews suffered at the hand of the Germans, therefore anti-Semitism we can't. But a great crime does not justify another crime.
Absolutely.
You cannot justify a genocide by appeal to a former genocide.
Definitely.
It's a Holocaust.
Yeah. Let's stay with the role of Christianity, Father Galli. I know you are Anglican, but I want to talk about the Catholic Church, you know, about the Pope. We had a Pope who was very pro-Palestinian, and now we have a new Pope who's talking about ceasefire. I've just heard him speak about, you know, but how much power does the Vatican has? Because they are saying these things, but nobody's listening to them.
Well, Stalin once, when someone mentioned the Vatican to him during, that was after the Second World War, said, how many divisions has the Pope? So he was put it quite brutally. Unless the Pope had several armed forces divisions, it didn't matter a fig to him. But of course, when Stalin died, Pope Pius XII said, now Stalin will see how many divisions we have in heaven, how many angelic divisions we have. So that was interesting. But coming back to your question, how many influence has the Vatican today? Well, it has an indirect influence. It has spiritual influence. In political, practical terms, the political influence is relative. And also, let us remember, the Zionists, whenever the church has tried to do something significant from the ethical point of view, they've trotted up some various charges, accusations. They come up for skeletons out of a cupboard. I remember when the American bishops wanted to condemn nuclear weapons, they immediately came out with a spate of thinking about sexual abuse. Maybe true, but I mean, it's interesting, were concocted by lawyers of a certain persuasion at the time. So I think the Vatican is also a little bit afraid of coming out too strongly in favor of Palestine.
It's the same controlling imperialist, Zionist leadership around the world that basically controls everyone. Let's very quickly, we have very little time, talk about the UK's role. I mean, recently, you know, David Lammy talking all these big talks about, you know, changing the tone and taking Israel to account. At the same time as F-37s, the fighter jets, are still dropping bombs. These are our jets here in Britain. You know, do you feel that there is any change coming, or is this just, you know, just words? And also, you know, we do say we are a Christian country in this country. When we're talking about Islamophobia, it's a big talk, you know. Where are the Christian values of this country?
Well, first of all, I don't believe that this is a Christian country anymore. It used to be, but it's no longer. The legislation which is enacted by the British Parliament very often contradicts the principle of Christianity on questions like abortion, gay marriage, and so on. Those are incompatible with Christianity. So the legislation of this country has become totally secular, totally, but sometimes unchristian. But David Lammy is a hypocrite because, of course, England, Britain is responsible for the fateful 1917 Balfour Declaration, which placed a very nuance and spoke of a national home, not the national home of the Jews in Palestine. It's been, but in reality, it has been, you know, how the snake put its head in to begin. So Britain should actually hang its head in shame. It's a responsibility. Should try to do the utmost to amend it. Once again, they're not talking. The Christian principles, no, I don't think there is much of Christianity involved here. It is that we have a situation whereby the Zionist cabal blackmails and manipulates everybody, and that is very sad. But of course, there are people who, I mean, you know, in my modest way, I'm a member of a group called Campaign, and we act and demonstrate outside church house in Westminster. I think I have a feeling you might have been there once.
Yeah.
So we try to do small actions of Christian resistance. And resist is the name of the game. We should resist in all possible ways. And this wonderful lady, Yasmin, she gives us a great example how to resist despite all the odds.
Absolutely. And resist we must, whatever our faith, whatever our skin color. It is the question of resistance in support of the truth. Thank you so much, Father, for honoring us with your presence. Really appreciate it. And thank you. Until next time, the artist Saif presents the sounds of Palestine. Goodbye.
Allah 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 Allah
Ya Rabbi
Allah Allah
Ya Rabbi
Allah Allah Allah
Nothing in the world can ever turn their hearts away from the calm of surrender they find when they say,
Allah.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio, broadcast from Tehran. I'm your presenter for the next hour. Today is Tuesday, 15th of July, 2025, corresponding to 24th of Tir 1404 on the Iranian solar calendar and 19th of Muharram 1447 on the Islamic lunar Hijri calendar. We start off this hour's programs with the Spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. After that, we have The Bridge. The program offers a brief commentary and presentation of the supplications of the Noble book, Sahifa Sajjadia. Our varied radio productions feature will round up this hour's programs. Stay with us for this hour.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Now, while the world has rallied and boycotted, sat in and walked out, yelled and interrupted, expressed every form of protest to bring about a ceasefire in Gaza, it still seems we're not any closer to ending the misery of the Palestinian civilian population there. Sources close the latest round of indirect ceasefire talks between Hamas and the Zionist entity in Qatar that started last Sunday aren't too upbeat about the way things are going. They say the Israeli delegation presented a withdrawal map that in reality outlines redeployment and repositioning of occupation forces. They said that Hamas has rejected the plan as it essentially legitimizes the reoccupation of approximately half of all of Gaza, turning it into isolated zones. And the state of affairs in Gaza and stalled efforts to change things there are the focus of today's Spotlight program. And now for your guests. Joining us, Mr. Mazen Qumsi, a Palestinian scientist and author from Bethlehem. And also Saad Nimr, professor of political science, joining us at Abirza University in occupied Ramallah.
The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess, Mr. Qumsi, we'll start with you out there in Bethlehem. Perhaps the time around Zionist leadership thought that after, more unprecedented barbarity, that Palestinians will accept anything they thought in Qatar from last Sunday up until today, and apparently that has not been the case. Your thoughts on why we're still, though, nowhere near securing a ceasefire in Gaza?
Well, clearly the Israeli government, and not just Netanyahu, as a full government, has never been interested in ending this war. They have a war that they think they can win. They think they can ethnically cleanse Gaza in stages, whether it's summarily moving them out of Gaza at the first instance or moving them to Rafah and creating concentration camp or a combination of genocide slash ethnic cleansing. And with the full support of the United States, I think they can succeed in this. So they are proceeding as such. They are not interested in any kind of quote-unquote ceasefire, because a ceasefire implies, as the Palestinians and the international world, the global community wants, is a ceasefire leading to end of the hostilities, leading to the end of the occupation of the Gaza Strip. And as you described, Israel wants to occupy 40% of the Gaza Strip, break it into pieces, and piecemeal continue the genocide and the ethnic cleansing, perhaps with a 60-day quote-unquote ceasefire, if it's acceptable to the resistance that they have a ceasefire that's temporary and that leads to renewal of hostilities, as happened before, and renewal of the genocide. So this is not acceptable to the Palestinian people.
Good initial points there. Professor Nimmer, thank you for your patience. Welcome to the program, sir. And your initial take, please, on why the U.S. and Israeli leadership at this point feel no sense of urgency at all to end the bloodshed and secure a ceasefire. The Israeli prime minister says it's Hamas's fault. They've been holding out all week, not accepting. Well, why would they accept it if it keeps your occupation forces inside of Gaza, in the middle of Gaza, in fact, in essence, partitioning Gaza? Who would accept that? And, I mean, that would add more of a risk and instability factor to the future for Palestinians there than it would give them Gaza back.
Good evening, Daniel, and also to your guest from Bethlehem and to all your viewers. Well, it's quite obvious that the Israelis are stalling all these kind of negotiations. They are not interested now in ending the war. It's not only the government and the right wing in the government, but also Netanyahu himself, because he couldn't achieve what he wanted from this war, or from this war against Gaza, this genocidal war. The idea from Netanyahu's point of view and vice versa, the Americans, is that they want a kind of victory. He wants to declare a victory somehow, and victory can't be attained. He failed so far in Gaza after more than 20 months in releasing any of the prisoners or to end the rule of Hamas or the strength of the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. So consequently, he wants to get that by the negotiations. And that's why he's putting all these kind of new conditions to the negotiations in order to pressurize the Palestinian resistance in the negotiations through the Qataris and the Egyptian and the Americans, especially with Witkoff. So what's going on now, and why the Americans and the Israeli, in spite of what they are talking about, you know, stopping the war, they want to stop the war. But from their point of view, this ceasefire for 60 days, and that will give Israel the right, or Netanyahu, to resume the war immediately after the 60 days. He could get a half of the prisoners captive by the Palestinian resistance, but